to our third board of leadership meeting. The last 2 years at Beck has been very hectic. I think if you come back to the downturn in 2010, it's been hectic working out of that. That's $5, man. We have fines, by the way, on our leadership meeting for certain violations. But now with the spouses here, I just wanted to say you might have to pay your spouse's fines too. So but seriously, I wanted to welcome everyone and thank you all for being here. You know, we realize that if we're going to have the kind of company we want to have, we can only do that as a team. And the better we know each other and the more time we spend with each other, you know, just the better our performance will be. And it occurred to us, having had two successful years in a row, that all of us have a bigger team, and that team is our families. And so we wanted to just spend some time collectively as an overall team and really thank the spouses for all the sacrifices you make to allow all of us to do what we do. So let's give all of the spouses a big round of applause. Now, this morning I was looked dead in the eye by my boss, Abby, and she said, now, how many things do we have to do that is mandatory? And, I'm really curious about that. I wanted you to know that this is the only mandatory thing. Everything else is optional. You know, my predecessor would bring us to these beautiful locations and we would just work, you know, 7-8 hour days. And one of the things I've tried to do is... One of the things I've tried to do is bring a little bit more relaxed culture to the team, so we're going to try to keep it relaxed and spend a lot of time in terms of downtime time so that we can really connect. One of the unique things we started doing about 4 years ago, when we start our meetings, we all do personal check-ins. And so I feel like even though we haven't spent a lot of time with all the spouses, I feel like I know you all very well, because we usually start off with how we're doing family-wise, how we're doing spiritually, and then we check in on business. And so we all get a pretty nice download of each other's family, and I think that's always a neat thing that we look forward to. But anyway, I just wanted to encourage you to have fun. I was asking Peter, we hadn't done one of these as a company in 8 years, so it's nice to be having some good times where we can afford to do this. So I just want to encourage you to connect with each other, spend time, get to put some names and faces. I'm sure you all hear too much about many of us. Don't act like I'm the only one that goes when we talk. Just remember, always put a little bit more good with the bad. So anyway, thank you all for being here, and I hope it's an enjoyable experience for everyone. I'm going to ask Holly, when we started this, we said, Holly, well, first of all, I want to thank Shannon and Holly for all the planning that went into this. I quickly learned that meeting planning is not one of the most popular things to do. And you know, people always bring you the complaints, and very rarely they bring you the good stuff. So Holly and Shannon have been brave to take this on, and a lot of the effort that went into organizing all of these options. I know they certainly did a lot of research. So I asked Holly to find a speaker. I said, I want a speaker that's going to be really exciting, appealing to everyone, and relative to what's going on in all of our lives. And so, and then really, really good. And I said, but no pressure.
Take that with
no pressure. So she came back after a few weeks. She said, well, I found the perfect person. So I'm going to ask Holly to come up and introduce our speaker. Thank you, Holly.
Talking a lot about is stress for our people, stress for us, and how do we continue to lead the organization and help us be better able to deal with our own stress, the stress that we create for our families, and then the stress that the work environment itself leads us to. So we started doing some research to figure out who could potentially talk about that, and we came across Dr. Sean Talbot. And I'm going to read you some of his bio because it's really very impressive. He has a dual bachelor's degree in sports medicine and fitness management. He has a master's degree in exercise science, and his PhD is in nutritional biochemistry. I don't know what any of those things mean. And his research focus has been on metabolism, weight loss, sports nutrition, and human performance. And he's the author of 10 books. One of them is On the Table for All of You to Look At. But he really is going to come and talk to us a little bit how to help us better deal with stress. What does stress look like? What causes stress? As well as we're going to learn a little bit more about sleep, about nutrition, and how to bring all of those things back together to help us be a little bit better and more well as we move forward. Thank you, Dr. Talbot, for being here.
All right. My pleasure. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks. So we're going to talk about stress in this wonderful, beautiful, no stress, low stress Sundance Resort. This is, I was telling some people before, Julie and I live about 45 minutes from here. So we get to see this kind of stuff all the time. This is probably the most beautiful resort in the whole state of Utah. It's small. It's tucked in here. You've got beautiful Mount Timpanogos right there. You're going to have just a wonderful time. So this is the best time. You're fed. You're watered. You're low stress area. We're going to talk about stress. I'm not going to talk to you today, though, about reducing stress. Has anyone ever tried to do that? Reduce your stress?
Stressful.
It's stressful, exactly. It's very stressful, yeah. And when you don't get your stress down, you get stressed out because your stress is still there, right? So it just compounds the problem. So with my background being in physiology and biochemistry, I'm going to talk to you about stress from maybe a little bit different perspective. I'm going to talk to you about stress physiology and stress biochemistry for the first part, just to give you what I hope is an appreciation for what's going on in your body when you're stressed out by a deadline, a financial issue, a relationship issue, whatever it is that causes stress. And we'll talk about some of those sources of stress. But once you experience that stress, and we all experience stress in different ways, certain things happen in the body, and that those hormones and those enzymes and those neurotransmitters cause us to gain weight, to be in a bad mood, to be anxious and be restless and be tense and be irritable and all those sorts of things. So I want you to have an understanding for the physiology of it all, because that I think will give you a greater appreciation for some of the recommendations that I'm going to give you. Not to stop that stress from occurring, right? That I think I take a very particular view. And in some of the academic seminars that I do, I'll speak in stress seminars where there will be people who are stress reduction people or stress management people, right? And that's great. That's not what I'm going to talk to you about today, right? I'm not going to talk about reducing, avoiding that kind of stress. I'm going to talk to you about being more resilient in the face of stress, almost from the perspective of you can keep piling on the stress, and as long as you can match that with enough resilience, you're going to be fine. In fact, you're going to thrive in the face of that stress. So I come at it from the perspective of physiology and biochemistry, but I also come at it from the perspective of sports performance. So as an athlete, back in my younger days, I spent some time at the Olympic Training Center as a cyclist in Lake Placid. Nowadays, I'll talk to the athletes. I also have a diploma from the International Olympic Committee in sport nutrition. So I'll talk to athletes and coaches, not about reducing their stress, but eating and supplementing to match that stress. There's a saying in sports physiology about overtraining. You know that if you train too much, that you're gonna get sick and injured and hurt, and you're gonna have actually poor performance the more you train because you're not recovering from it. On the sport nutrition side, we actually say that there's no such thing as overtraining. There's only undereating, right? That you're not matching the recovery aspects to the stress aspects. And that's what I think makes a lot of sense for people who are in business, for people who are out there, you know, trying to finish a project or get a project or keep a project on budget or keep a project on a time frame, right? Those are all stresses that aren't going to go away. You can't just say, sometimes you can, but often you can't say, let's just increase the budget and everything will be fine. That'll lower our stress. You can't say that, right? Or let's increase the timeline and, you know, give us a few extra months, right? You can't do that very often. So that stress that you have has to be matched or counterbalanced with some sort of resilience, okay? So the first part of what I'll talk about is the science piece of it to give you that understanding. And then the second part of what we'll do after we take a break is some practical recommendations. How can you eat? How can you exercise? How can you come at it from the perspective to match that stress? Okay? Does that make sense to everybody? So stop me at any time. If you see something up here that you're interested in, you want to go dive into deeper, we can do that. If you have a question about something that's up here, let's address it. Don't hold your questions till the end or anything like that. And we'll just make this as interactive as we can. Okay? So, this is the big thing that I study. So much so that that's what my license plate says. Vigor. Has anyone ever heard that word before? Vigor? You've probably heard it in the terminology of like vim and vigor, right? That sort of old-fashioned, you know, you're feeling good and, you know, it's that kind of 1950s-ish ring to it. But vigor in psychology research is a very defined metric of how we can measure how somebody is feeling. Here's the definition of it. It's a three-tiered sustained mood state characterized by physical energy, mental acuity, and emotional well-being. So when your vigor is low, you feel fatigued. When your vigor is low, you feel confused and muddled and you can't remember things. When your vigor is low, you just feel kind of blah, which is not a scientific term, but that's the term that we all use. Anybody know what the opposite of vigor is in psychology research? It's a word you all know.
Lethargic.
Not lethargic. You feel lethargic. You feel depressed. Depression is actually a different kind of a metric that we can measure. It begins with a B. Bored? Burnout. You've all heard that before, right? So we can measure in our studies, we can measure burnout. If burnout is high, vigor is low, or vice versa. So we can measure them either way. I like to measure vigor because it's a more sort of positive affirmation kind of a thing. So when we look at athletes, we can measure their vigor prior to a competition, and if their vigor is low, they ought to not even start the race, right? It's that predictive of performance. Physical and mental performance. If your vigor's low, you're not going to be able to concentrate. You're not going to be able to execute on a plan. You're not going to be able to be in the zone, so to speak. That's another way of describing what you're feeling when your vigor is high. Athletes who are low in vigor or high in burnout or overtraining for a period of time also have suppression in their immune system. They have a suppression in their body's ability to recover and repair from their workout. So they're more likely to get sick. They're more likely to get hurt. When they're traveling and they're not getting enough sleep, we can measure their vigor. And we can literally suggest that they scratch because they can go into a competition with low vigor. And not only will they not perform well, they're more at risk for blowing out a knee or getting a tendonitis or coming down with a cold, which is going to exacerbate itself into future problems. So that's what vigor is all about. A lot of the work that I do is when I'm not lecturing about this kind of stuff is the way we actually pay the bills. I do product development for a lot of companies. The product development, I'll talk about these kinds of things, dietary supplements, later on. But in traditional medicine, vigor is the same thing as, anyone ever heard of this word before, qi? So qi in traditional Chinese medicine is what? How would you describe that?
Your energy.
Yeah, your energy, your life force. You know, sometimes it's mental and physical energy. Sometimes it's called vital energy. Sometimes it's called, in TCM, it's called qi. In Ayurveda, Indian medicine, it's called prana. In ancient Greece, it was called pneuma. Like all of these traditional medical systems around the world have a word for that life force. And when it's gone, and you feel depressed, and you feel fatigued, and you feel all the things that you don't want to feel. But when it's back, you feel like you're on top of your game. So a lot of what I do is we look at what those traditional medical systems used, what herb, what root, what stem, what leaf, and then we'll use Western scientific techniques to figure out what's in there. So why did they use green tea? It's not because of the caffeine, it's because of these compounds called catechins. Why did they use various mushrooms? It's because of these compounds called polysaccharides. So I'll get into a little bit of that, because I think it's important that some of the recommendations I'll make to you later are less around reducing your stress, but almost inoculating yourself or vaccinating yourself against that stress with nutrition or with sleep or with some of the techniques that I'll talk to you about. So just to give you a sort of a slight preview, blueberries are one of the best anti-stress foods out there because the flavonoids in blueberries can actually reduce some of the stress hormone exposure that you'll get when you're under stress. Right, so we'll talk about how that works in just a little bit. So I'll come back to this in the next part. So this is a word cloud from this book that you see on the table, The Secret of Vigor. My daughter, who's 17, is duly impressed that I know how to go on the internet and make a word cloud. The size of the word is indicative of how many times that word appears in the text of the book. So you can see vigor, of course, I talk about that a lot in the book. And stress is a big thing that can lower vigor. Inflammation, balance. You know, another way to think about this is that if you're in balance, your vigor tends to be high. If you're out of balance, your vigor tends to be low and your burnout tends to be high. But you also notice that there's a lot of biochemistry going on here. Biochemical, cortisol I talk about a lot, sleep I talk about a lot, inflammation I talk about a lot, because in a lot of ways, the stress response, because it's a biological, biochemical, physiological response, you can't say to somebody, just deal with it, right? Just deal with the stress. That would be very similar when you're under stress and your cortisol level goes up. Somebody and your cortisol level is just boiling your brain and boiling your fat cells and boiling everything in your body. For somebody to say, well, just deal with the stress when you're in that state is very similar to somebody saying, okay, I'm gonna hold my breath. Just don't breathe. Just don't breathe. Eventually, you have to breathe, right? It's that strong of a biological signal. So let me give you an example. Has anybody ever, at the end of a stressful day, drive past a McDonald's on the way home from work, and you think, that looks really good, right? It looks really good because you're under stress. When we're under, you've heard of stress eating before, right? The reason we stress eat is because of that hormone cortisol and some other hormones that I'll talk about. But when that stress hormone cortisol goes up, it's specifically telling your brain to fuel your body because your body thinks that it went through this big, long, energetic stress response. So we're craving things when we're under stress, like cupcakes and Big Macs and French fries and, have I hit on your thing yet? Oreos and, you know, all of those sort of comfort foods.
Red wine.
Right, red wine. Which actually has flavonoids in it, which are good for your stress response. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. So how prevalent is stress, right? Stress is all around us. Right? I'm not going to go through all these statistics, but just to put some numbers to it, the three at the bottom here I think are very instructive. No matter what body of statistics you look at, from American Psychological Association, from the World Health Organization, the CDC, or the American Institute of Stress, somewhere between 65 and 90% of North Americans have enough stress where it results in some sort of a stress-related disease, right? And that means everything from obesity to diabetes to depression to anxiety disorders, all of that is linked directly back, not indirectly back, directly back to an overactive stress response, right? And when I talk about stress, I'm really talking about chronic stress, right? So stress is actually a sort of a, it's a dual kind of a situation where a little bit of stress, short-term acute stress, is wonderful for us, right? It sharpens our memory, it improves our immune system function, it lights a fire under our butt so we get things done, it makes us feel alive, right? A little bit of stress is good, but as soon as you have a lot of stress, or stress chronically every single day and you're not recuperating from it, that's when it becomes chronic, and that's when your body starts to break down. I'll give you some examples of that as we go through here. Here's some of the stress-related conditions. So I mentioned a little bit already, obesity, depression. Even things like anxiety and ADD, where you can't concentrate, you can't stay on task, those are very much stress-related. And those make sense to a lot of people, right? That, okay, I'm under stress, I can't think. I'm under stress, I can't remember. I'm under stress, you know, some of those sort of metabolic ones make a little bit of sense. But look at some of these other ones. Things like osteoporosis, right? Cortisol can actually break down your bones at a faster rate. And this is how I got into this field. I was a nutritionist when I was getting my PhD at Rutgers. We were the first lab in the world to show that when you diet to lose weight, everybody knows that when you diet to lose weight, you lose some fat. What else do you lose? You lose some muscle, you lose some water, and you lose some bone. We were the first ones to show that. And when we showed, wait a minute, the skeleton is going away when we lose weight. Why is that? It's because the stress of the diet increased your cortisol, and cortisol is a catabolic hormone. It breaks down every tissue in the body. So when you're under chronic stress, everything's breaking down. Your bones are breaking down, your brains are breaking down, your skin is breaking down, your muscles are breaking down. It's not a good situation to be in long term. And if you chronically put yourself, you're just on a slow downward slide, it's not a very pretty picture. So where does all that come from? Where do all those sources of stress come from? Number one is financial, right? It's emotional stress. It's deadlines and traffic and bills mostly. Every time you go to the mailbox and you open up the mailbox, what's in there? Not love letters, right? Bills, right? That's the biggest source of stress for most people. But you can see some of these other ones. Physical stressors, like sleep deprivation, which I'll talk about extensively in just a little bit. But aging, all of us are going through that right now. As we age, cortisol goes up and other hormones like testosterone go down. I'll talk about that in a little bit. Environmental stress, heat, cold, air, water pollution, non-optimal diet. So I'll focus a lot of my recommendations later on things that you can avoid in your diet because they'll increase your stress response or make your stress response more active when you're under stress. And I'll talk about other things that can, as I said before, kind of inoculate you or vaccinate you against that stress response. But when we're eating a lot of Doritos or Big Macs, like I said before, or any kind of processed foods, those are bad in and of themselves because of blood sugar changes and things like that. But because they're lacking in phytonutrients that I'll talk about, the fact that you're getting bad stuff and not getting the good stuff ends up being sort of a double whammy. So the moral of this slide really is that the sources of stress, the sources of chronic stress and a chronically activated stress response are everywhere. We can't avoid them. They're inside us, they're outside us, they're all around us. And that's why I take the perspective that I take, that we are going to be exposed to chronic stress. And we can't just say, avoid stress, reduce your stress. Those are nice things to do, but I think impractical for most people, especially in the kinds of lives and careers and things like that that we need to live in. One of the things I think is interesting, though, is that the stress response, this chronic stress response, is exactly the same across some pretty broad categories of stress. So that I can say things like this, that athletes and dieters and people who are called short sleepers and people who are chronically stressed all share the exact same stress response, the exact same biochemistry. So the same things that I'm going to tell you this afternoon are the same things that I'll tell the Olympic level athletes at the Olympic training centers. It's the same thing that I'll tell a group of people who have been dieting to lose weight and have hit a weight loss plateau. Has that ever happened to anybody before? You lose weight for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, everything's going great, and then you stop losing weight. The reason you stop losing weight is because that dieting is viewed as a particular kind of stress by the body. Your stress hormones change, you plateau, and you have to do something different to get yourself off that plateau. It's just a change in your stress response. So there's lots and lots of benefits that we can get if we have an appropriate stress response. We can have better physical and mental performance, we can lose weight, we can have better sleep, which is good for lots of things, and we can feel a lot better. Our vigor can be higher and our burnout can be lower if we do the right things. So too many people find themselves in this state, tired, stressed, depressed. And what they end up doing is what? What do you do when you feel like this? What do most people do? And you can tell me it's what your friend does if you don't want to admit to it yourself.
Eat chocolate.
Eat chocolate? That's actually not such a bad approach. We'll talk about why. What if you're tired? What's the best-selling thing at a 7-Eleven?
Coffee,
energy drinks. Yeah, multi-billion dollar industry because people are tired, right? You're tired. You need something to get to the end of the day, right? Some help, and so you go for an energy drink. You're depressed. Antidepressants are the number one prescribed class of medications, right? And I'm not an anti-pharmaceutical guy by any stretch of the imagination, but if chronic stress is the problem that's causing you to feel depressed, and there's probably half. half of all depression is directly linked to the chronic stress response, then taking an antidepressant is probably not the right tool for the job, right? It's maybe on the target, but it's not hitting the bullseye. We'll talk about why. But when you're feeling like that, I come back to this. Because of my background, I'll come back to these kinds of research studies that show that the right food can make you feel better because it's giving you an appropriate stress response. The wrong food can make you feel worse because it's exacerbating that stress response. So things like fast food and commercial baked goods, you know, cupcakes in a cellophane wrapper, that is probably the worst thing that you can eat for your risk of depression, right? Because... but there's lots and lots of different things that we can do to increase quality of life, increase vigor, increase focus. Here's a very simplified example of that. This study looked at kids going off to school in the morning. How many people in here have school-age children? Okay, so here they are at 8 a.m. They're going to have a breakfast. What you're looking at is their deterioration in attention from that breakfast over the first few hours of the school day. And a higher number is a worse number. So here's no breakfast at all. Their attention deteriorates pretty quickly in the red line. If they have just a glucose drink, right, just a little bit of sugar, their attention deteriorates a lot quicker, right? They get that glucose surge, but they get zzz, they can't focus on anything. Here's what happens if you just have Cheerios or Shreddies. In the UK, it's shredded wheat, same sort of thing. Just that little bit of blood sugar control and cortisol control allows them to focus better over the course of several hours, right? That's what nutrition can do. And as I mentioned before, very simplified representation of that. But when you're in that tired, stressed, depressed kind of a category, people will look for the very quick, simple kind of a thing. You can see all the antidepressants that are up there. You can see the coffees and the Red Bulls and the rock stars and those sorts of things. You can see sleep drugs. As I said before, I'm not an anti-pharmaceutical person, but that's $80 billion of expenditures in the United States alone every single year because we don't feel the way we want to feel. We're tired, we're stressed, we're depressed, we're off, we're irritable, we're tense, we're restless, we can't relax, all because of that chronic stress that we're under. And I'm going to show you some data from some of the studies that we've done that show that if you balance these aspects of biochemistry with diet and exercise and lifestyle, things that are very easy for people to do, you can balance oxidation, inflammation, stress hormones, and blood sugar. You can restore vigor in a way that's as quantitatively as large as pharmaceutical treatment, okay, without some of the side effects and things like that. All right, one of the things that's good about this is that you don't have to balance all of them at the same time. Sometimes I'll put that up and people just go, well, forget it. It's too many things, right? One aspect of biochemistry that's good is that it's a dominoes game. Once we balance one of them, the other ones kind of rebalance themselves over time. The thing that's frustrating about it is that when one of them gets out of balance, the other ones get out of balance. So if we're overstressed, we very often will see blood sugar problems later on. When we see that, we'll see inflammation problems later on. When we see that, we'll see oxidation problems. So you can think of this as you're under a lot of chronic stress, now you're at risk for diabetes, now you're having more pain, lower back pain, and you're more achy and things like that, and now you're having more wrinkles, right? All because of the stress response. It's a very dismal... You guys aren't liking what I'm saying, right? This is all bad, bad news. There's good news at the end of it, right? That
sounds
we can set this up. So here I come to Calvin and Hobbes, right? Here's Calvin. He's selling a swift kick in the butt for a dollar. You guys know anyone who needs that? That's a useful product, right? Lots of people in the world need that. Calvin or Hobbes comes along. How's business? It's terrible. That's hard to believe. I can't understand it. Everybody I know needs what I'm selling. I actually don't know a person that doesn't need some sort of cortisol control. And that's primarily what I'm going to talk about now, is not so much stress control, because that is That's a big thing. What stresses you out might be completely different than what stresses me out, and what stresses you out and what stresses you out, right? We all will respond to the same stressor in a little bit different way. Right? But we're all going to be stressed out by something. We're all going to have an overexposure at some point to cortisol control, or to cortisol. And so you need to control that. So what is cortisol? Have you guys ever heard of that before? Yeah, most of you are nodding your head. The body's primary stress hormone. There's lots of stress hormones. So if a cougar came off the mountain there and came walking in the door, right, we'd all have a stress response. We'd have a fight or flight reaction. It would get us to jump up out of the chair and run away. That would be great. There's other stress hormones that happen, but cortisol kind of persists in the body. It's there after a couple of seconds, and it might stay there for a few hours. So that's one of the things that makes it so important to get under control. A little bit of cortisol is a good thing. Just like I said before, a little bit of stress acutely is a good thing. A little bit of cortisol is good because it helps with all these great body processes, inflammation and carbohydrate metabolism and blood pressure. But too much for too long leads to a problem. It's very similar to what happens in the body with cholesterol. We all have cholesterol in our bodies. Our livers make cholesterol. We eat a little bit of cholesterol in our diets. We need it. It's very important for cell membrane structure. It's important for hormone synthesis. We couldn't have zero cholesterol, right? But we also don't want it to be too high because then it clogs our arteries and gives us heart disease and things like that. The idea with cortisol is the same thing. We want a little bit. We want it to go away. We want a little bit. We want it to go away. So it can do its job but not get us into trouble, which is that catabolic response. So stress exists on this continuum. Acute stress, when it's brief, we can adapt to that. When it comes and it stays, we can't adapt to that. And it's not just a human thing. Any mammals, but any animals that we've ever looked at also don't do well with a stress response. And probably the best example from the animal kingdom is, and we know this from the studies in rodents and studies in primates, monkeys. We know it from studies in worms. We know it from studies lots and lots of different animals. Chronic stress, the animal breaks down. The animal gets sick. The animal dies after a while. The best example probably is salmon. Right? Think of a salmon's life when it's getting ready to spawn, right? It doesn't eat. It swims all day long. It doesn't sleep. It's always trying to go upstream. If you were to look at a salmon after it spawned, after it spawned and it was done, have you ever seen a salmon in that situation?
They're ugly.
Yeah, their scales, they have open sores, they have parasites. If you look at their gastrointestinal tract, it's completely broken down. Because of that cortisol response all the way along. Same exact thing happens to us. The way that we explain it to students when we teach stress physiology is like this. If anyone ever wants to read a really good book about stress physiology, this is it, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. Have you ever read this book before? Or you're familiar with this? So the idea here, written by one of the top stress researchers in the world, Bob Sapolsky, and just, he's the one on the left in this picture. He's a brilliant guy, hilarious guy, but he's pictured here with his research subject, a baboon. For, I don't know, 20 or 30 years, he spent his summers, summer vacation from Stanford, in Africa, studying baboon social hierarchy. Why should you care? Who do you think has the most stress in a baboon troop? Do you think it's the head honcho baboon? The one who's making all the rules and screaming at everybody and making sure everyone's doing their whole thing? Think it's the guy at the bottom who's just getting yelled at all day long? Or do you think it's the people, the baboons who are sort of in the middle? Who do you think it is? It's not the top guy.
It's the middle people.
It's the middle people. Yeah, people will usually think it's the lower bottom, right? They're just getting told what to do. They don't have a lot of stress, actually. And the way that they measure this, they'll actually dart the baboons. They'll take a blood sample. They'll measure their cortisol levels. They'll look at immune system cells. They'll look at how many bugs they have and, see what their immune system looks like and all that kind of stuff. And it's the middle managers that have the most stress because they're getting it from both ends. They have to make sure that the baboons at the bottom are doing their job, so to speak, and they're getting yelled at from the top of the pyramid, right? So it's those ones that have the worst. They have more visceral fat, more belly fat. They have more more parasites. They have just a worse baboon life, the people who are in the middle. And it's because of this chronic stress response. So this is what your stress response should look like. You know, the cougar comes in, it scares us. There's the lion right there. We see it, we mount a stress response, the fight or flight reaction happens. We either fight it off or we run away. And 60 to 90 seconds later, the stress response is over. So our cortisol level spiked, our cortisol level went away. Perfectly adaptive, perfectly healthy. Actually, that is healthier than having no stress. Right? That makes your immune system stronger. That makes your brain stronger. It makes you grow more neurons. It makes your muscles stronger. It makes your blood sugar control more optimal. It does everything healthy. We should go through that on a fairly regular basis, but not a chronic basis. When we go through it every single day or several times a day and we don't recover from it, this is what a human chronic stress response looks like. And as sort of higher animals, our stress response comes from even thinking about the stress, right? So you can have an encounter with your boss or an encounter with your staff or an encounter with your spouse and it sets off a stress response. You can think about those encounters and it sets off the exact same stress response. So the fact that you had that argument and now you've been thinking about it all day and you're going to have it again when you get home, chronic stress all day long, chronic cortisol exposure. So I have very dramatically here, stress is killing us. Because that stress hormone, cortisol, is catabolic. This is what our normal diurnal cortisol rhythm should look like. Assuming we had no stress in the day, right? We just sort of woke up, went about our day foraging for lovely fruits and things like that, right? Sort of Stone Age, Paleolithic kind of a lifestyle. Your cortisol would be highest about 8 o'clock in the morning, 7 or 8 o'clock, whenever the sun woke us up, whenever we got up and, you know, got out of bed or got out of the, you know, the leaves we were sleeping in. That would be the highest exposure to cortisol we'd have throughout the whole day. And then it would dissipate slowly, slowly, slowly until it reaches its lowest point sometime in the middle of the night when we're at our most relaxed, most deep sleep, you know, we're recovering at our highest level. That's what a cortisol rhythm should look like. This is what it does look like, though, for most people. You know, we get our cortisol waking us up and getting us ready to go and face the stresses of the day. And then we have the kids to school, we have errands, we have work, we have meetings, we have all that kind of stuff. And the difference between the red line up there and where our blue line physiologically should be, that's cortisol overexposure. That's the extra cortisol that we're experiencing. And what it's doing to the body is not very good. It spawned a whole new field of research called psychoneuroimmunology. So the idea here is that stress, or any of these sort of mental parameters that are going on, are interacting with the rest of the body through a couple of mechanisms. So there's a hard wire from your brain to the rest of your body through your nervous system, right? Your brain is perceiving that stress. That stress is being transmitted through your nerves to your liver, to your kidneys, to your gut, to your big toe. It's also through the endocrine system, the hormone system, and through the immune system. These three systems interact with each other to sort of manifest that stress in terms of health. And stress is really what we're talking about here. Here are some of the conditions that are linked to cortisol dysregulation. So if your cortisol is up for too long and you don't get it back down to those normal levels, the ones in red, if you can see that in red, are the ones that I'm primarily going to focus on. But you almost can't think of a condition that's not on this list. Right? Obesity, especially abdominal obesity, appetite regulation, that stress eating I talked about a little bit, diabetes, impaired immune system response, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of these intuitively make sense, but there's really, really good research to show the direct link. So I'm gonna dig in a little bit on some of these. So with appetite, this is probably one of the key places where cortisol has a very direct impact on almost everybody. Very good studies have shown that women especially, women seem to be more prone to this aspect of cortisol than men are, and we're not exactly sure why. Women with a high cortisol response compared to those with a low cortisol response consume more calories. Of those calories, eat significantly more sweets and have more negative moods, right? So how many people have experienced this sort of thing before? A bunch of hands went up this high. Right? It happens a lot. And it's important, I think, for us to realize that that's something that's going on in your body. And the research studies that we do that I'll talk about in a little bit, once people understand that, you know, intellectually they know, aha, it's a thing that's happening in my body. There's a hormone that's responsible for the reason that I feel sad and want to eat cupcakes when I'm, and I say that a little dismissively, but that's exactly what you're experiencing, right? That when you're tired at night and you've had a rough day, that you should expect that that's going to happen. And what should you do? Eat the cupcakes. Does that make sense? Yeah, you shouldn't eat the cupcakes, but you could eat a little bit of chocolate. You could eat a little bit of something else. I don't want to give away what I'm going to talk about later, but you could eat something that's going to give you the same, it's going to satisfy that same signal. Your body is telling you, you need to eat this sugar because of this hormone in your body, because it's kind of telling you. Does anyone know why it's, why would cortisol want to send us that signal?
Wants to store up energy.
Exactly. For the next stress response, right? So think of it from the perspective of you being the zebra. If you just ran away from the lion or fought it off, you expended a lot of calories. You burned energy. And so for you to survive for that next stress response, you're probably going to need to fuel up so that you have the energy for the next stress response. But if our stress is traffic and bills and all the things we talked about before, we're not expending that energy. And we're just putting more calories in. But that's how the physiology of it works. It's one of the reasons that exercise is far and away the best anti-stress solution, because it takes you through that stress response. It in a sense, it burns off the cortisol. It doesn't really burn it off, but it puts it back to where it needs to be. It puts you back into that low cortisol state. So that's what happens with some of the appetite things. You know, I mentioned that one of the reasons that I got into this stress response field is because of the work that I did in osteoporosis. Some of the women that we looked at in those days were women with disordered eating. They had anorexia. They had what's called high dietary restraint. So not only were they exercising a lot, over-exercising, I just said good things about exercise, but that's a two-edged sword too. You can over-exercise, and that was causing a stress response. But they also had high dietary restraint, which is basically, here's the definition, consciously trying to limit food intake to achieve or maintain a desired body weight. So hasn't everybody gone through that? This is sort of the Uber version of just watching what you eat. If I had a plate of chocolate chip cookies up here, and I said, come on up at the break and have some cookies, and we'll socialize a little bit. Some of you would come up and go, yeah, cookies, awesome. Low dietary restraint. Some of you would go in the back and go, he's a nutritionist, and I don't want to see my friend. You know, I don't want her to see me eat a cookie, and it's going to make me fat. And like, the worse you sort of talk yourself up like that, that's high dietary restraint. Just the psychology of you pushing that away increases your cortisol. And the more you're like that, the more cortisol you're going to have. That was just what I was going to set up. That was perfect. So now your cortisol is higher. So now you want the cookie even more. Right? That's a terrible, terrible cycle to get into. And the only way to fix it is to short circuit it. Just eat the cookie. So, you know, in a sense, just eat the cookie is actually the right way to go. But just eat the cookie, not eat the plate of cookies, right? It's very hard to stop that. And that's when we talk about the practical aspect of this. Some of making rules that you stick yourself to can help you with that, right? You know, I'm gonna have the ice cream, but I'm only gonna have the ice cream in this dish and not this dish, right? Like those sort of little rules that you can put around your lifestyle can help in a lot of ways. We'll talk about those later. So when you do gain that weight, when you do have those extra calories coming in, cortisol is a little bit insidious here. It's gonna make you gain weight. if you have high cortisol exposure, but it's specifically weight in the midsection. And we know this because the fat cells in your belly fat region are different than the fat cells in your thighs or your butt or any place else in your body. They have more cortisol receptors, and each of those receptors is more sensitive to cortisol. So if you have a little bit of cortisol, it's really going to stimulate the abdominal fat region and not so much stimulate the fat cells in the other parts of the body. So the, you know, you get that stress eating response, you eat the cookie, it goes right to your midsection. And that's a biological region, reason. The reason that's so bad isn't purely cosmetic. It's not just that we don't want to have a big sort of beer belly, apple shape kind of a thing, right? The reason that's so bad is because of this kind of stuff. That kind of fat is more associated with diabetes and cardiovascular disease and syndrome X and high blood pressure, and all the bad stuff that's associated with obesity is really associated with this specific abdominal fat. So we want to make sure that we get that cortisol under control. This is what it looks like in some of the research studies. This is looking at a couple of different things. It's looking at cortisol levels based on stress levels, and it's looking at cortisol levels based on years in work. So this one makes a lot of sense, stress-related cortisol. The more stress you have, the more cortisol you're going to have. But the work piece, the years in work piece, doesn't always make sense. So more cortisol, more abdominal fat. What's the years in work? What does that have to do with anything? If you're this person who's been on the job for more than 21 years versus this set of people who's been on the job for less than 10 years, what's the 21-year person have going on? Continuous stress, right? They've been on the job longer, so they've been exposed to stress for a longer period of time, right? That's one thing. What's another? What can you think that these people are going through that these people aren't?
Slower metabolism.
Part of it, these people are just older, right? There's an aging effect going on here. As we age, metabolism goes down because cortisol is going up. And as we're aging, cortisol is just going up. So as we're sitting here right now, we're getting older. Every second. Bad news. Cortisol just goes up with age. And I'll show you a chart on that for a little bit. And there's one more piece. There's one more factor that's going on here. So they've been at it longer, we're aging and metabolism is changing.
You're just collecting more?
Compounding.
Not so much that. Well, the compounding thing is that you've been there for long and exposed to it. These people are more senior. They've got more responsibilities, right? There's more stuff coming at them all the time, right? So yeah, more stress, more things on their mind, more things on their plate. This is what happens as we age. So cortisol goes up. Testosterone goes down. This happens in men and women. Women have 10 times less cortisol or testosterone than men, but any little drop in it is very, very noticeable. Very noticeable. Women lose a little bit of testosterone, their muscle mass goes away, their muscle tone goes away, their metabolism goes down, their metabolic rate goes down. They're more likely to gain weight because of that change in cortisol and testosterone, the ratio between the two. And it ends up looking like this for all of us, men and women. These are CT scans of somebody. If we took somebody and sort of cut them right in half with a lightsaber, right at the level of the belly button, and we're looking down, this is a cross-section of their abdominal region. So here's the spine. Here's the kidneys back here. The belly button would be at the top of the screen here. And so these are two people with the same 32% body fat level. This person has a normal stress, normal cortisol situation. So two different people. I've colorized the abdominal fat. And you can see here there's not a lot. But they still have 32% body fat. Where's the fat? Yeah, might be the legs, might be their butt, could be their big toe. Doesn't matter where it is. It's not in their belly. And that's good. This person, even with 32% body fat, is going to have lower blood pressure. They're going to have better blood sugar control. They're going to have probably better longevity. They'll probably live longer than this person that's carrying all of their fat right there in the belly region because of their cortisol exposure, because of their stress response. And you can see that there's a lot of it in there. Okay, that's going to interfere with blood sugar. It's going to make higher blood pressure. It's going to do all kinds of bad things. So your belly is growing in response to stress. Your brain is shrinking in response to stress. The only tissue in the body that doesn't break down in response to cortisol exposure is that belly fat region. Everything else, your immune system, your skin, your bones, as I mentioned before, your neurons, your muscles, everything accelerates its breakdown. And this is why it's bad for athletes, but this is also why it's bad for all of us. Here's a normal stress, normal cortisol neuron taken out of a mouse brain. You don't need to be a neurologist or a neuroanatomist to look at the difference between those two and just understand that looks better, doesn't it? It's bigger, there's more projections, it just looks healthier. Compared to this one, it just looks physically shrunken, it looks sick. Right? This is pretty advanced chronic cortisol exposure where you see a physical structural degradation of that tissue. But way before this happened, this mouse brain wasn't good at remembering and thinking and finding the cheese. Like there's a functional impairment in our brains when we're under stress before there's a physical impairment. So this particular part of the brain, the hippocampus, is where our memories are stored. So when this gets to a pretty significant level, there's a question of will it come back? And you know, I'm showing you rodent neurons here, but the same sort of studies have been done with MRIs to show that pilots and flight attendants and long-haul truck drivers and people who are under sort of chronic stress, sleep deprivation, and have to focus, that exact same thing happens in their brains. Right? Are you guys under chronic stress? Do you have to focus? And do you sometimes are sleep deprived? Right? That's most professionals that I know these days. Same exact thing is happening to all of us. And then the question becomes, how can we bounce back from that? So here are the sort of the big four areas where cortisol levels are elevated. Chronic stress, aging, we all have those. Dieting and restrained eating, we talked about that a little bit. And then sleep deprivation. What do you think is the average hours of sleep most people in America get these days? Four is a little bit low. How many are we supposed to get? Do you guys know that? 7 to 8. Yeah, it's a little bit different depending on who you are, what sort of stress you've been under, did you exercise that day, how old are you? There's a range, but 7 to 8 is a pretty good average for most people. So what do you think we get? It's higher than 4. It's about 6. Yeah, and it's been going down, 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 down. And the reason that is bad is because sleep deprivation is a very unique kind of stress. We all know somebody, they might be sitting right next to you, who thinks they can get by on 4 hours of sleep. Right? Those people are exceedingly rare. Maybe not even quite 1% of the population can really get by and function optimally at that low level of sleep. So if you're in that category, great. But chances are very great that you're not. When we are sleep deprived, these are some of the things that happen. Cortisol levels go up, but it interferes with lots of other hormones in the body. It interferes with blood sugar control. That's one of the reasons that we get such a profound abdominal fat deposition. It interferes with insulin resistance. So it basically puts us in a pre-diabetic state, even if we miss just 1 hour of sleep in the night. So here's some of the studies that you see, the link between cortisol and blood sugar. What I want to focus you on here is that how little sleep loss you actually need to put yourself into a bad, bad state. So normal sleepers averaging 7.5 to 8.5 hours of sleep a night, that's what we're supposed to get. So that's sort of the control group, I guess, in these studies. And then short sleepers who average less than 6.5 hours of sleep per night. How many people would be in that category on a pretty regular basis? 6.5? Most, maybe half the people in the room put their hands up. Very often, if I do a big public seminar, 80% of the hands will go up of people who get 6.5 or less hours of sleep per night. In those people, they've got 50% more cortisol, which interferes with their insulin, so the body overproduces insulin, and 40% less sensitive to the effects of insulin. So that right there, that's pre-diabetes, just because you missed 1 to 2 hours of sleep. That's huge, huge health effect. And the thing that people really care about, sometimes I'll say that and people will be like, ah, oh, diabetes, no big deal. But then I put this one up and people gasp, right? Because they go, I'm gonna gain weight. Well, wait a minute, I don't want that. I'll take the diabetes, but I don't wanna have another notch in my belt. This is what happens. I'll cut to the chase here. Each 1 hour loss of sleep is about equivalent to 3 pounds that you're gonna gain. And that just adds and adds and adds and adds. And you'll see how much it adds when I show you the graphs in just a second. So you can see some of the statistics there about how many people are getting less than 7 hours a night. It's just, it really is an epidemic in certain ways. And the thing that's frustrating about it is so many people just think, well, I'll just be tougher. I'll just deal with it. I'll just get by. And you can't. Remember when I showed you that neuron picture before? And showed that it physically breaks down, you can't prevent that from happening. You can't prevent your brain from breaking down. You can't prevent your muscles from going away or your bones or your skin. It's going to happen if you're exposed to cortisol at those what are really minorly high other, you know, higher levels. I mentioned before about a functional impairment before that structural degradation happens. So when you're under stress, you actually can't make good decisions. Your creativity is much suppressed because of the way that works in the brain. I'll talk about that in a little bit, but those are very, very real things that impact on our jobs and impact on our health and impact on our relationships with people. Here's what that looks like graphically: body fat percentage and sleep. So here are the normal sleepers. And what I want you to look at is how a normal sleeper compares to a good sleeper, 9 to 10 hours, which, does anyone in here get that much sleep, 9 to 10 hours of sleep a night? That's great. I never find people who are in that category. If they can get that, fantastic. But that's a big chunk of your day. That's a big chunk of downtime. If you can just get this, 7 to 8 hours, that's going to be good for a lot of people. But what you're looking at here is body fat percentages. So about 23%, about 32%. A short sleeper is going to be significantly higher than that. So here's men, 26% versus 23%. 3% extra body fat in a man, all of it in the midsection if you're that short sleeper, right? You're missing an hour or two of sleep. And then women, it's even more pronounced, 32% to 36%. Again, all in the midsection there, right? That's what stress fat is. It's belly fat. If we look at girth, waist girth, you see the exact same pattern. I'm going to skip over this. If you look at risk for weight gain and you compare a normal sleeper and we give them a 1 as the control group, what's your risk? Your risk is 1.7. So 70% increase in your risk of gaining weight throughout your whole body just because you're missing an hour of sleep. Right? So at this point, people will sometimes ask me, they'll go, well, I don't have enough time to sleep. So what's the solution? Right? If I can't get 7 to 8, what am I going to do? I don't get 7 to 8. Julie doesn't get 7 to 8. What do you think that we do?
Exercise.
Yeah, and then the trade-off becomes, is it better to exercise for an hour or is it better to get an hour of sleep? What's the best way to go? Anyone want to vote? Kind of depends, unfortunately. So sometimes hitting the snooze and going back to bed for an hour is the best thing for you to do. Sometimes exercise is the thing for you to do. But in all the cases, you want to make sure that this 6 is as good as it can get.
I want to be careful here because at all of our leadership meetings, we have an exercise period for an hour and a half.
Uh-huh.
And I think some people in this room will make a really rational argument.
To sleep in?
Take a nap instead of going to the exercise.
Right, right.
Continue that.
Yeah, so an ideal scenario is going to get both, right? But that's utopia. That's not where we live. Question?
Can you explain again why when you have more sleep, your odds go up?
Yeah, this is
for belly fat too.
Yeah, there's a theory about this. We don't know exactly, but we think that people who are sleeping this much might be depressed.
Yeah.
And so the depression is causing a whole nother set of not cortisol related, but similar sort of neurotransmitter effects that are going on that are making you eat more. So that might be what's going on there. So, you know, this is another one of those examples in biology where the middle ground is where we want to be. We don't want to be on either extreme. You know, that we want to be in sort of that sweet spot.
So you really don't want to sleep more than 8 hours a day?
You don't. No. Like, you know, you want to have enough stress. You don't want to have too much. You want to have enough sleep, not too much. You want to have enough food, but not too much. Right? It really comes back to that. It sounds boring, but it all comes back to that balance concept. And it's a matter of finding where your balance is at one particular point. So, to use an example from the world of athletics. How many people have heard the term periodization before with training? You're a 3:10 marathoner. You've probably heard of that word before, right? You're a 3:10 marathoner, right? 3:10. 3 hours and 10 minutes to run a marathon, right? So when you're training hard for a marathon, right, you're putting in your miles, you're running a lot. Are you eating more?
No.
Are you sleeping more?
No.
No? Okay, you just blew my theory then. So most of the time, when you're training a lot, you have to recover a lot. When you're training a lot, you're burning a lot more calories, so you have to fuel a lot. So if you're training a lot and you're not fueling more, you're probably losing weight. Right? So that idea of balancing or taking your training in periods where you're training a lot and you're recovering a lot, and you're training a lot and you're recovering a lot, and then you have an off season, right? That idea, the same aspect that we use for athletes all the time, we should think about, right? You have a hard week, you need to have a hard recovery. Like, you really have to try to put that in. That's where the resilience comes in. The resilience doesn't come in by saying, I need to back off my stress. The resilience comes in and says, I have this much stress, I need this much recovery. I need this much off. Or I need this much. I had a stressful meeting. I need a stressful workout to help me recover from that, to burn off so-called that cortisol. You're going to ask a question.
Is this adults and children?
This is adults. The same thing applies to kids, but kids are even tougher because this 7 to 8 for a teenager is going to be 8 to 9 to 10. Right, so their baseline of where they need to just be normal, just be that control, is actually bigger. So we've got two teenagers, and it is tough because we work all day, they work all day, they're under stress from school, and they're under stress from all the social stuff that teenagers go through, and they're on their devices and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, we finish a long day, we have dinner, we want to spend time with them, and we're like, oh my gosh, it's 11 o'clock. Boom, we just blew the sleep thing out of the water, right? So it's very difficult to actually put that into practice sometimes, but it's important to do. So this is sort of the lead-in to why I asked you what's more important, sleeping or exercise. Can you just sleep yourself thin, right? Maybe if we just slept more, we'd all be skinnier. So when you do a ratio between normal sleepers and short sleepers, if you got the normal amount of sleep, your overall fat, compared to the short amount of sleep, your overall fat mass would be 16% lower. That's huge. That's better than any diet plan I've ever designed for any company, ever. Right? Just getting enough sleep. Just getting the sleep versus not getting the sleep. It's profoundly important. And then you can see overall weight, BMI, body fat percentage, waist percentage. But it all goes in the right direction if you're getting the right amount of sleep. And it all comes back to why? Cortisol exposure. Okay? So with that, I'm just going to conclude here, and then we can ask questions, we can take a little break, whatever we want to do. There's take a nap, we'll go for a workout, whatever you want to do. You have to control your cortisol. I don't like to talk. You can see I started talking about stress, and then I for the rest of the time I talked about cortisol control. The reason that I do that is because to say to a group of people, myself included, I want you to reduce your stress or control your stress or manage your stress. It's ludicrous, I think, right? If it's not ludicrous, it's at least very difficult to do. But if we boil it down to what is actually the problem about stress, that it's this cortisol overexposure, there's some things that we can do that directly get to that cortisol. Your stress is still going to be there. The things that I'll talk about in the next section will control your cortisol. They're not necessarily going to get rid of the traffic jam. They're not going to get rid of your deadline. They're not going to get rid of your workload. They're not going to get rid of all the the other things you have going on in your life. Those are still going to be there. But we're going to be able to change your stress response so that you don't have as much cortisol exposure. So it's a very biochemical-oriented approach to, like I said before, inoculating yourself against this as the problem, cortisol overexposure, so that you can still thrive in that stressful lives that I think most of the professional groups that I talk to don't want to dial their lives back, right? They don't want to do less. They want to do more, and they want to do more in a state that helps them thrive and be healthy and bounce back appropriately. So that's what we're going to talk about in the next section. Okay, so we'll take a break, and then we'll come back in a little bit. All right?
Questions?
Any questions right now? Yes, please.
What's your opinion, if you have one, on intermittent fasting?
I love it. Intermittent fasting is one of my favorite approaches. We try to do it once a week, right? So a lot of definitions of intermittent fasting.
For how long?
So anything. Anything longer than an 8-hour period counts as a fast. So if you, just eating dinner and then not eating until breakfast, that's a fast, right? That counts. What I like people to do is have a dinner, go through the night not eating, skip breakfast, skip lunch, eat dinner. So that's a 24-hour period, right?
Then you're going to have a big ribeye?
No, well, you know, that's what you would think, right? When you do that, a lot of the change that happens, your appetite will get cut. So you'll be hungry at breakfast, probably. You'll be really hungry at lunch. But by dinner time, you've actually started to, your hunger has started to tail off a little bit. So when you look at that big ribeye, it might look okay, but you're only able to get halfway through it. You know, so have you tried intermittent fasting before?
Do it once a week then?
We try to do it once a week. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But yeah, and once a week is probably enough to get the benefits of intermittent fasting. So one of the big benefits of intermittent fasting is longevity, right? The studies can't be done in humans, but they've been done in monkeys. They've been done in all sorts of mice and rodents and things like that. They live longer if they follow this sort of an approach. So sometimes they're fasted 3 days, sometimes they're fasted 5 days, sometimes they're fasted longer than that. But one day seems to activate the pathways that give you all of those benefits without you feeling like you're starving yourself. Okay? There's a very popular diet out right now called the 5-2. Have you guys ever heard of that one? So you eat normally, you eat whatever you want for 5 days, and then you fast for two. Right? And that's pretty extreme. And you would think you'd like, I'll starve myself for 2 days, and then I'll eat nothing but cupcakes and ho-hos and ribeyes. But you end up not doing that because you do that for a couple days and you feel sick.
Consecutive days?
It is consecutive days, yeah. You know, and I don't think you need to do that. Like, the best research from the NIH, National Institutes of Health right now, shows that if you do just, the way that I explained, one day a week, that seems to activate enough of the pathways where you're getting the benefits without feeling deprived so much.
How do you avoid being sort of, agitated, like hangry?
Yeah. Don't do it what?
When you're thinking.
Yeah. So I'm very susceptible to that, right? So much so that I used to do a lot of media work. I would travel around the country and do, all the talk shows and things like that. And the woman that I used to travel with, the PR woman, would have power bars and things like that in her purse because I would get hangry, right? My blood sugar would go down and I would be very snippy in the interviews, and that's not good for the client, so she'd feed me before I would go in, so my blood sugar was high. The best way to not be hangry is to sort of graze yourself throughout the day. This is one of the things that I'll talk about in the how to eat section.
Yeah.
But dosing yourself so that, the ideal way, just to give you a little preview, the way we eat now, 3 meals a day, terrible. Is it really not how we're supposed to eat? You probably all heard the thing, you're supposed to eat breakfast like a king and eat dinner like a pauper, right? Eat your biggest meal and then a medium meal and then a tiny meal for dinner. That's actually not a bad way to do it. An even better way to do it would be to graze throughout the day. Have a little bit of something, a little bit of something, a little bit of something. So you're having a little bit of calories, mixed, blended stuff every 20, 30, 40, 50 minutes throughout the day, right? So it's a sort of snack, 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 snack. So you have nice normal blood sugar control. The reason for that, because if you have big blood sugar spikes like meals, it sets off your cortisol response. It's a stress response. So your blood sugar problem becomes a cortisol problem, which becomes all these other problems that I just talked about. Okay, yeah.
I have a basic question about sleep. Does it have to be continuous sleep?
It does. There have been some studies of can we do it in little blocks? You know, can you sleep for 20 minutes and, you know, do naps have the same sort of an effect? And they don't. And one of the reasons is that if you remember the cortisol rhythm graph that I put up there, it takes hours for your cortisol to actually get down to those lowest places. And so one of the problems with 5 hours of sleep versus 8 hours of sleep is that you just don't have enough time for your cortisol to come all the way down to that lowest level. And if it doesn't get down there, you're not getting into your REM stages of sleep. You're not getting you're really not getting the restorative, recuperative benefits of sleep that you would get in those last final hours. So sadly, it doesn't work very well.
Yeah. So if you sleep for 4 hours, you wake up for like 15 minutes and you go back to sleep. That
right there might not necessarily be bad, right? If you're able to slip back into those deeper stages, you'll probably be perfectly fine, right? But people have tried to actually done some experiments to say we're going to sleep an hour and we're going to get up and we're going to do some work and we're going to sleep an hour, and you add up all those and we got 5 hours over this period of time. It doesn't cut it.
And the other question is, obviously, when you're a teenager or infants and teenagers, when your body's growing more than it ever will in its life, you need those extra hours of sleep. Conversely, as you age, do you need less sleep or not?
Yeah, we do need less sleep, but there's a controversy about we need less sleep from a neurological perspective, but we probably need the same amount of sleep from a physiological perspective. So your brain is on a different time clock when you're 70 or 80 than your body is. And so you still need those more hours to fully recuperate your muscles and your hormones versus your psychology, which doesn't make sense. Why would they be off? That's kind of a question mark still. Any other questions before we break? Okay, great. We'll take a break for how long and then come back for a little bit?
What do I do, 10, 15?
Okay. Thank you.
The stress is amazing.
Everybody take a quick nap, right?